Hey, folks, welcome to another exciting episode of A Radio Geekly. And like the intro stated, we're going to be celebrating 50 years of things because, whoa, like, KBOO Community Radio has turned 50 years old this year. And we are going to celebrate that by talking about KBOO, but also about other geeky things that are 50. Yeah. My name is Just Jess, and I am joined here in the studio by some of our collective members. I've got Becky and David. How are you all? Doing
pretty good.
Good morning.
Awesome. Yes, but before we can dive into this celebration of 50 years of things, I wanted to take a moment to recognize that we had some unfinished business to take care of from last month's episode. And Becky, what did we do about that?
Well, we sat down as a collective, had a few folks in the room, and we sure danged talk about it.
Yes, we sure dang did. And so we actually have a podcast that you can listen to, and we took the time to cut out a segment for mm-hmm. this morning's episode to play of that conversation. So we're going to get to that right away and come back and then talk about 50 years. But first, here is some more unpacking from last month's episode. Hey folks, thanks for joining us for this bonus segment of A Radio Geekly, where we talk about geek consumerism. And if you were listening to our show, we talked about consumerism and geek culture, and the term gentrification came up, and we wanted to take a moment to actually unpack that and help define what we mean by gentrification within geek culture, because it is definitely something that is different than the actual definition of the term. So we're going to take this time to unpack it for you and give some clarification on what we mean, and hopefully to help educate all our fellow geeks out there on consumerism. So I'm Just Jess, and I'm joined by collective members Jenna, Becky, Tabitha, and Rob. Hello, how is all of you today?
Hello.
I'm good.
Yeah.
I kind of wanted to start with a definition. Like, what is the definition of gentrification? So one thing that I noticed in looking it up online is that it is a fairly whitewashed thing. Mm-hmm. Like, the idea of gentrification that has been put on Wikipedia and all of these other things is that it's an example of formerly low-income, air quotes, neighborhoods where longtime residents and businesses are displaced by white-collar workers and overpriced coffee houses. Now, that totally ignores the underlying fact that those neighborhoods are historically African-American or populated by historically marginalized groups. And I think that that in of itself is emblematic of what gentrification has become to white society, and that white privilege definitely even just exists within that idea of gentrification and is almost recursive in the way that it appears in everything.
Yeah,
and so I think that's the same for geek culture as mm-hmm. well.
I wanted to thank you for that definition, Becky. Mm-hmm. I think it helps set the foundation for using the term and clarifying what it means, because a lot of listeners were probably hearing that word and going, wait, this is not, how does this relate mm-hmm. to consumerism within geek culture? How is this the same? Because this is not, and especially for our people of color listeners, it was probably borderline offensive, if not actually offensive to them. And so I want to apologize on behalf of our collective too.
Thank you for the clarification, you know, of the definition. I definitely think of that as a very kind of recent idea of gentrification. You know, gentrification is a term that's been around for decades, mm-hmm. and it has been applied to not just our modern society, but how we look at like past civilizations too, how like oftentimes, you know, it's about oligarchy coming in and displacing and marginalizing, say, immigrants or whatever. I mean, this is all historical things that are constantly happening. But I think what's really important is, like, as you were saying, like within code switching, you know, the definition, I think, of how we think of gentrification today, especially like within the United States, is so loaded with race, and that mm-hmm. we can't use that term in the United States without acknowledging race. And if you don't, then you are whitewashing the term gentrification. And so it's, I have to admit, like, I wasn't part of the last episode. I was listening, and I was one of those POC who was actually offended by the conversation. And I was kind of like, I understand what they're trying to say, but I think that it's just taking that term gentrification in its very generalized sense and how you can apply it to like almost any civilization. But within our modern society, within the United States, and especially we're going to be talking about American geek culture, it's like, mm-hmm. I think that it serves us best to apply our racial understanding of gentrification, because that's so important with, even within geek culture.
And as you said, the narrative being that we have to take a look at it with that lens of race, but also the intersectionality of classism, of capitalist culture, and a number of other like deep-seated oppressions needs to be part of that conversation too. And I think what makes it really interesting to take a look at geek culture as, you know, like perhaps something that is a colonizing force is the fact that, you know, not only is it this one thing, the forcing out of certain peoples, but also the misappropriation of stories, of making spaces less safe for folks. And I think that that's where kind of I want to, you know, talk a little more is, you know, there were really interesting ideas put forth in the last episode that if we just dug a little deeper, then we would be able to like, you know, kind of draw out that like colonialist culture that kind of dominates everything.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Jenna, I know that you were mentioning you have somebody that you know that could not afford to have their booth at a Wizard World convention now because it's just so overpriced. And that impact of now their content is not being exposed in these events, and they have to find other avenues to make that happen.
The phenomenon of artists getting priced out of a space is also, not only does it force people out, it forces POC artists out of the room, literally. It also opens them up to misappropriation and people seeing that mm-hmm. art mm. for that time. You know, like there's something about the way that people remember things and the way that we misattribute yeah. inspiration and information that then creates an opportunity for the art, the stories mm-hmm. of people who are being forced out actually to be then taken and then capitalized by white
yeah.
people.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's such like a good example of where we often, I think, conflate the terms like gentrification versus discrimination versus mm-hmm. like classism, where all these things intersection, you know, oh, like yeah. intersectionally happen. And so you can have gentrification happening at the same time as discrimination, and it can be two different events for two different people stemming from the same thing, right? So one example I have of that is, oh, and Tabitha knows about this because I'm always cringing at this dude at conventions. And I think I've talked about him on the air before, but there's that guy who does the Japanese woodblock prints, and he's
let's not say his name because we don't need to give him permission.
I don't really know what his name is, but mm-hmm. so he is a white person who sells Japanese woodblock prints, and it's this sort of thing where, you know, had, say, a Japanese person tried to make this before, you know, maybe they would have maybe been able to do it, but now they've been totally priced out. Mm-hmm. And he can afford to do it mm-hmm. because, you know, he just has been around for a while, and also he's just, I won't
he's
even
also
say.
White?
Yeah, that too. But so he has a lot more resources. He can stay in. And so what are the Japanese woodblock prints that are being made in a traditional style? Who's consuming it? It's ultimately white people buying this white man's art, feeling as though they are buying something legitimate. And I can understand why, because they're like, oh, a Japanese artisan is doing this, but they're not the ones profiting off it.
Yeah, and this guy's just a middleman. He didn't make
it. Right, and he's selling a lot of art that is not actually Japanese. You know, he's doing like airbender stuff, like stuff that is kind of on the cusp.
I see, yeah.
And so you are actually pushing out an artist of color or potential for the artist of color, because here is this person who's coming in and has more means mm-hmm. and is catering to the white narrative that like, hey, this is what anime is, and this mm-hmm. like stuff that yep. Asian people themselves wouldn't recognize. Mm-hmm. And yet he's the one making the money, he's the one getting the recognition, and he's the one allowed in the room.
Yeah.
And so that's when I see, like, oh, here was a space that was maybe could be occupied by somebody who had authenticity with it and agency about it. Mm-hmm. And then it was taken away from them in this very whitewashed way, where it's like, oh, look how pretty this is. We're doing this. This is about Asian appreciation, stuff like that. And you're just like,
I think one thing that's a really fertile ground for discussion in this way is how hip hop was transformed into nerdcore, which is dominated by primarily white rappers talking about nerd things. You know, I love, who is it? The one that does the Adult Swim stuff.
MC Chris,
yes. I thought, like, he's usually, like, super hilarious and stuff, but there is a trend amongst people that are making that sort of music of, you know, being in positions of privilege and utilizing an art form that is traditionally one that is outspoken and powerful against the oppression of people of color.
Yeah, I kind of wonder, if we're just talking about nerdcore music in general, why aren't there more POC musicians? Because I am sure that there are POC geeks out there that have lots of musical talent, but I'm sure they're out there trying to get their music out there, but why is it that these white artists are the ones that are getting invited to cons and performing at conventions and not these other POC musicians?
That's a good question.
Well, and then another question I have is getting back to kind of like what Becky was focusing on, of just you know, why is it so many white people? Yes, but I also quite wonder how many POC want to participate in it? Because I think of nerdcore as an extremely unwelcoming white space. One thing I don't like about how they treat hip hop is that oftentimes I believe in geek culture that hip hop is often treated as ironic. Mm-hmm. Right? It's like, oh, look, we're going to be nerdy and do nerd raps. And while we understand the humor maybe in that like juxtaposition, even when they're doing it seriously, the irony is part of it. It's part of the genre for sure. That's so cringy to me, where it's like, wow, the origins of hip hop are about empowerment, you know, and that irony is a privilege to be able to have, because hip hop is not ironic. It is full of
social
expression.
Commentary.
It's full of pain. It's full of historical trauma. It's full of, you know, historical empowerment. And then to have people oftentimes like even try to attach their own oppression to it or their struggle or attach irony to it. It just,
MC Paul Barman is a super good example of that.
It's
for
cringy,
sure.
Like, you know?
And almost like highly misogynistic for sure. I agree. Cringeworthy. I think, I wonder how much of that is part of the like social capital of othering, like that geek culture is so very much like kind of brought into, you know, like focus, because now you're the other, you're interested in something that's not highly popular. It's made fun of. And, you know, that there is this like switch of identification amongst people who don't realize that they have privilege, but are feeling underprivileged because they like are a part of this, like, I'm a nerd, I'm a geek, and I have this specific social capital of being into something that's different and cool according to me, and I don't have to share and blah blah blah. And then having that be the switch where you're like, oh yeah, I am oppressed actually, because like I am a nerd. This sort of othering, I think, mirrors in my mind the development of whiteness in American culture. Like, I think that, you know, the idea that we're removing, like, you know, specific cultural identities so that people who exist in a working class, lower class kind of way to identify with people that have power is similar to this. And the whole, I think, you know, there's a bunch of mechanisms behind that, but the one that's in play in both of those is capitalism.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, capitalism.
Cha-ching, cha-ching.
Down with capitalism.
I'm talking about, like, controlled messages to kind of get back to this gentrification thing and why I found our last show kind of cringy to listen to. I wanted you guys, because I was listening to the show, and I wanted you guys to touch on what that's not so much about its intersection with like consumerism, but about what is gentrification. Because once you guys brought up the term, I was like, mm-hmm. oh my God, they're going to bring up gentrification within, mm-hmm. you know, geek culture. And then it ended up being more of a conversation about consumerism because I think it's so important to talk about where we actually see gentrification happening, right? Like, mm-hmm. so, and just in the comic book stories, like freaking Superman and Captain America.
I was thinking about Superman because Superman was actually created by two Jewish guys, and he's become like the symbol of like truth, justice, and the American way. And like he was originally created as like an immigrant allegory because these guys were Jewish from a Jewish immigrant background, and they were putting their experiences on ink and paper, and now he's become the symbol of Americana. And so I definitely feel like that's kind of an example of gentrification, mm-hmm. and definitely whitewashing, how mm-hmm. even though he was never coded as Jewish, but he
right, like,
has become
like this sort of origin story that
comes from layers on top of that, right? Because like mm-hmm. we always want to say, oh, the American story is about the immigrants and we're all immigrants. Oh my God, it drives me nuts. Right? But then like, what is that? That's really a gentrification of like the first gentrification that happened in this country, where we're like, oh, there's nobody here, and we could improve the land, right? So let's just like pretend that Native people were never here. Let's pretend mm-hmm. like their story never existed. So let's say, what is an American hero? It's Superman. Mm. It's Captain America, right? It's these very white narratives where we say, what is it to be an American? What is all American, right? So I just look at what are our most popular comic stories, and to me, it just reeks of gentrification. It's like, who are our real heroes? Who is this?
If there are any indigenous comic artists out there, make us an indigenous comic.
Well, there are so many. That's the thing, right? We, I mean, mm-hmm. we had that show where we talked to people from Indigenous Comic Con, mm-hmm. right? And like, I'm like, wow, how do we elevate those stories mm-hmm. to the top? Do we say like, there's our Superman. That's what we need to be heading towards the United States, where we say, these are our real heroes. These are our real stories. Let's stop putting the beautiful, shiny apartment out, which is AKA mm-hmm. like Captain America mm-hmm. in his new, way too tight outfit. Tight. Anyhow,
I'm just gonna complain about the tight outfit.
Okay, it's just me. I don't know. I guess I want everybody in long, flowing robes or
it's
something.
Movement wear.
I want
movement.
Everybody to be a wizard.
That's fair.
Yeah, like I dig the Ringwraith costumes. But yeah, just those sorts of things where you're just like, oh, wow, this comic culture is, you know, United States, and it's very much embedded in white supremacy and like how we choose to start, where is the American narrative? And like, that's where the gentrification comes in. So you can't mm-hmm. erase that from when you go to conventions and the consumerism, and that's where it's all coming from, mm-hmm. right? It's mm-hmm. like all of this is an attempt to erase indigenous and native voices and to attempt to say, this is our land. Mm-hmm. It's like, mm-hmm. oh, ouch, ah, mm-hmm. cringy. Ever in my mind applied the term like gentrification, because I always think of it so much as just like housing. Mm-hmm. But if we're extending this term here, to extend it into like the whitewashing of like Asian roles, like recently, you know, it's like when I apply gentrification, I'm like, oh, that makes, oh my God. Cause we always just call it whitewashing in the Asian land. We always like, oh man, they whitewashed another role, but it is feeling forced out in a way that feels like gentrification, right? Cause when gentrification happens, right, then the developers and whoever comes in, they earnestly probably believe themselves. They're like, we're just trying to improve the neighborhood. Yeah. Like, it's not as though we hate you. It's just, you know, we're just trying to make things like shinier and cleaner or whatever. And it's like, oh God. Right. But so when you're bringing in a white person into a role that is obviously supposed to be played by somebody else, you're saying, oh, look at this shinier, cleaner version. And so much of the time the media wants to say like, oh no, it's just a character, you know, it could be played by anybody. It's not something specific. But then as an Asian person, all I can see is, all I hear are the racism and the racist things I've been told my whole life. Like, my eyes aren't big enough to be on camera, because I was an actress for a while, and I was always kind of being told this, like, your eyes aren't big enough, you're gonna have to open them more, right? That you're like, you're too dark, or you're too this, you're too that, you're not enough, right? And so you're constantly being told you're not enough, and then they bring in like the prettiest white lady in the world to do all the, like, Scarlett Johansson or Natalie Portman, and you're like, oh, we're looked as though we are dirty, like that we're less than, that we can't even represent ourselves, that we couldn't tell the story good enough, so we better bring in something shinier, more modern and new,
right?
To tell your story. Wish we could have a conversation within geek culture that is similar to the conversation that's having at large right now about feminism.
Yes.
Right? Where it's like, feminism is not about equality of everybody being the same, right? It's about a recognition that, like, wow, we need to talk about all the things that make up, and we need to talk about the toxic masculinity that is a part of feminism. We need to talk about how men play a role in this. We need
What's up with TERFs?
Yeah, we need to, like, redefine a lot of these, or make it very clear what these definitions are, so that we can say, oh, am I that? And then make new definitions of like how people are saying, let's redefine what masculinity is, right? Like, that's so much of what feminism is right now. It's like, hey, oh, wow, y'all, there was nothing wrong with women. Let's talk about toxic masculinity and how that's actually what feminism is about fighting, right? So like in geek culture, I wish we would have that larger discussion, like, hey, let's just talk about whiteness, how geek culture is whiteness. It is toxic mass. It's my favorite yet least favorite intersections. Oh, it's so easy to identify, right? Patriarchy and white supremacy are the foundations of geek culture, and that, like, we're needing to fight back in that, and we're trying to do it within feminism. And it's like, hey, can we also do that with race? Can we have, like, serious conversations about POC are being gentrified out? Like, that's just kind of how it goes. That's, like, intersection sometimes with class, but oftentimes not. Okay, I gotta say this. I gotta really recognize how we're failing still on Radio Geekly in this moment, is that out of everybody that participates in geek culture, the people in this room are probably some of the least oppressed. That it's problematic that we are talking about the most oppressed people in our society and not including them in that conversation. And we're like making suggestions about, you know, what we should do. Yeah. And stuff like that. I mean, and it's a difficult part of our society because, like, we do have to have these conversations. And we don't want to tokenize people by being like, hey, give us all the answers, right? And so we do have to have these discussions amongst each other. But I hope that what our listeners at least take away from this is to go, like, I'm not going to take them as the voice of authority, you know, because, like, I know you guys can't see us, but in this room are white people, white passing people, and East Asians, which in this country, we might as well, East Asians pass as, like, white people, basically.
None of us can speak to the Latinx or the African American.
Right, we can't speak to, like, Native struggle, you know, and erasure and stuff like that. Go back into the, like, hey, let's just keeping ourselves accountable. Like, I know that even, like, if I was listening to this conversation, I'd be like, it's a little cringy, because, yeah, like, we just need to keep emphasizing that, like, the way we use gentrification in this conversation is really minimal compared to what
Its definition, and that, you know, is a place of privilege too.
It totally is. Yeah. Just because, like, when I think about gentrification, you know, especially in Portland, like, I think of, like, the historical redlining, right? Well, that happened in every single city, right? The redlining. And I'm like, okay, so where was that? Where do we see redlining happening within geek culture? Like, we don't, because, like, redlining is a really horrific thing that it's happening by the government, right? So that is far more than just, like, well, consumerism, well, like, right, like, that's it. Gentrification on that level has a much deeper trauma and, like, historical, you know, context to it. So I don't want people to be listening to think that we're not
That we're minimalizing
like what that is, because redlining is a big deal.
And also bring to light too that we're not the end all be all of the solutions.
Yeah.
Oh no.
You know,
I wanted to thank all of you for, you know, digging into this a little deeper. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening and giving your feedback from last month's episode. And we just wanted to show our appreciation and know that your voices are being heard. So thanks to everyone who gave that input and were able to add to that conversation. And where else can you do that but here on community radio?
No.
And this is a Radio Geekly. I'm just Jess. I'm joined in the studio by Becky and David. And we wanted to talk just more about why it's so important to have 50 years of community radio here. KBOO is celebrating 50 years of broadcasting. And I thought it would be a good time for us to talk about why it's so important to have a resource like community radio that is KBOO. And a cool thing that's actually happening here in the city is there's an exhibit at the Oregon Historical Society.
Right now
that you can go and check out, and it actually gives kind of a timeline as to how KBOO was formed. And Becky, you were a part of that process of putting the project together and overseeing a lot of things.
Yeah.
And how was that experience for you?
Well, it was tough. I have to say KBOO's history is so deep and rich and involves so many people that it was, for somebody like me who joined the KBOO, like, you know, community in only the past 5 or so years, really difficult for me to grasp, like, you know, all the different players, all the really important shows, things like that. I was just learning about JW Friday and the Soul Strip that he pioneered way back in the day, and I am so excited to learn more about that work and the impact that his show had on the community. But, you know, it's very easy to miss details when you don't have that long institutional knowledge. And I think it was a learning experience. I learned a lot about KBOO, a lot about what happened in its development, or in our development, because, you know, it's a community rather than like a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But KBOO had some really innovative approaches to programming, some like controversial, some like really, really experimental. And I really appreciate that there is a space for that. I feel like commercial media is difficult because it is primarily created and programmed to be an attention market for advertisers, and that there is no concern perhaps for like what people want to know or learn or what might be important to them. And so community radio is a relief to that. And I'm proud to be a part of a community effort that has stretched for 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that longevity is important because it means that, you know, together with only the purpose of democratizing media and having this kind of liberatory access, that's real, and it definitely works and it can be sustainable.
Yeah. And the importance of having a platform to talk about things, you know, like geek consumerism and gentrification and unpacking really controversial topics on a platform that's accessible to a lot of people is, I think, a valuable asset for our community. And being able to have that happen for over 50 years, you know, is amazing. And I don't know if this is true or not, but I believe KBOO is one of the only community radio stations that's been along for 50 plus years.
Well, there are others. The Pacifica Network, KPFA, okay. KPFT, KPFK, WBAI, all those, WPFW, and others. I think that might be it. But anyway, KPFA was founded in 1945, I believe. And that, you know, KBOO is one of the very first like independent stations that started that way, that has kind of kept to that particular, like, you know, value set and community organizing model. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
We were founded by a number of folks, but it includes the people up in Seattle at KRAB at Crab, who were part of this Crab Nebula. And out of all of those, KBOO is one of the last ones to be around. So I think that's important. It's an important part of the history. It's an important part of approach to radio that was really revolutionary at the time. Because as I said, you know, radio just divided up into commercial broadcasts, into religious broadcasts, and into educational broadcasts. So, you know, in 1968 in Portland, KBOO really was kind of the only cool thing happening at that time.
Yeah, and it's pretty awesome to see that a lot of these materials are still in good condition at the exhibit. So you can see old program guides, you can see photos, you can actually see part of one of the original Air Room soundboards, mm-hmm. With all the knobs and dials and things.
you can't touch it. Sorry.
You can't touch it. It's in a nice little kit, like display case. But you can see it at the Oregon Historical Society from now and through July.
Yeah, July right? 29th.
Yeah.
It'll be live and surprised. I don't know. I'm not good at rhyming right now. But,
yeah. And you can get more information just about the exhibit and about KABU, the 50 years of KABU, on a special website that we have.
50yearsofkabu.fm.
Right.
That's the place.
Yeah. And there's photo archives. There's audio archives. It talks about the exhibit there. There's things that you can do to support KABU right now, and even just get information about their upcoming events. We're going to have a street festival mm-hmm. coming up in the summertime. We had our opening exhibit just a few weeks ago, actually.
Oh, yeah.
The grand opening, and that was really fun. We had volunteers helping out and taking some live recordings mm-hmm. from people's experiences and music and everything. And so it was really great to be able to experience that. And you can too, folks, by going to the Oregon Historical Society and checking out that exhibit and going to 50yearsofkabu.fm to get more info on that as well.
That's right. Get radio geekly.
There you go.
Whoa.
There it is.
Yeah, when I saw them hauling out the cartloads of stuff for that exhibit a few months ago, I was like, well, what is all this old stuff? And I gotta wonder, like, now that they have this exhibit of things that are 50 years old and, you know, the span in between, mm-hmm. do we have to hold on to it for another 50 years, you know?
Right. Forever.
Like, this back room is just going to pile up with everything for the next, 100 years. And then we're justified for saving it when we have exhibits like this, because it is pretty neat.
Well, you bring up a good point, because a part of this exhibit is it's meant to be kind of an awareness piece that KABU does have 50 years of material that really document the political and cultural life of Portland as it developed over 50 years. And one of our, you know, big deal works is to digitize that, to make it freely accessible and online available to researchers, to the public, to youth, to anybody who's interested in learning about this really critical piece of radio history. So yeah, we're figuring out where to put it, but it'll be in like temperature controlled robot arms or something.
I like the tech. I like the stuff, and it's kind of neat. You know, when you see, because a lot of it doesn't get preserved. I'm just thinking mm-hmm. of like all the different mediums we have for just saving just media in general, you know, how stuff has changed and how it's like compressed, how quickly things change. Mm-hmm. And it's neat when, you know, everyone like now, like how many people even have a VCR? Well, that's going to come back. And you're like, you'll watch videos of going, look at this, this was a VHS VCR, something ridiculous like that.
Look at it. It's on magnetic
tape.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you're going to be nostalgic of it, you know, forgetting just how terrible the thing was. But, you know, it's just, but, you know, it's neat. And it's neat that we have.
Yeah. Well, there's so much that was lost, especially from, you know, well, I mean, broadcast history in general, because like so much of those mediums were just overwritten. And then when we lost the ability to play things, then we threw them away or put them someplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's the radio waves. It's ethereal. It just kind of goes out and we let it go.
It's I think an interesting discussion at some point about like what our expectations for institutions mean for archiving, or like how we access material in the first place, like, you know, like art in a museum, radio waves going out into the black hole of space. Does that, I mean, like, where are our responsibilities with that? Do we just let it go into the world?
Part of it gives more weight and importance to what we do have. If you look at, you know, just the old photos that we, you know, well, there's a photo album. Everyone's got, you know, thousands of photos now that no one wants to look at. And I can, you know, but that's where it means more, because it wasn't, you know, it's just rare. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's
fascinating.
Yeah.
What will the future look like?
Mm-hmm. Everyone's going to be totally exposed.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah. It's it's something to be said that the longevity of KBOO has been around, and that they're just listening to some of the audio archives and stuff too, and hearing about pivotal points within the history of Portland and in just community radio in general was really, really amazing to listen to. And the fact that it was still in, you know, fairly decent audio quality, you know, I know a lot of it probably took some time. I'm pretty sure a lot of those files needed to, you know, be cleaned up, and those tapes needed to be dusted off, and, you know.
Oh yeah, they were heckin' like delicate,
right?
That's for sure.
Right.
Cooking? Did they cook any tapes? Do you know anything?
Well, I know that folks, you know, wanted to do it in house, and that was part of the workflow. And I think ultimately we outsourced it to a bunch of professionals.
The experts.
Yeah, because also there's like metadata piece about the technical details of it that I think, you know, like there's so many aspects to digitization that. I think really it requires a sort of a thoughtful approach and consistent and, you know, systematic. So that there's probably baking, though. They're probably like big industrial ovens that are just filled with reels of tape at this point.
It's a neat industry. Yeah. I wonder if we can get into that.
Yeah.
We
actually, you know, KBOO is actually looking for somebody to help with some of those.
Oh, yeah. Right.
If you have thoughts, if you have expertise, if you are a professional in the
archivist,
then please get in contact with KBOO.
Go to our website.
There we go. And it's right there on the homepage.
KBOO.fm.
Find out the information.
Yes.
And so, I just wanted to have this time to just express our gratitude for KBOO for being a community resource for 50 years and counting.
Mm-hmm.
I know for myself, it's been really great to connect and build community, just being a part of this community here. So,
yeah, and having a place for geek stuff.
Geek stuff.
Yay.
Yeah, so we're going to talk more about the geek stuff, other things that are 50 years old. But if you have some thoughts you want to give into things that are 50 years old, maybe you have some cool insight about the early history of KBOO that around the 50 years, you can give us a call here, 503-231-8187, and our wonderful board operator will take your call. But we're going to transition now from talking so much joy and love on KBOO and talk about more joy and love on other geeky things that
are
50 years old. But first, I wanted to play this little kind of brief clip on some things that were happening in 1968 and see if you recognize some of these geek things.
Archie's here. Betty's here. Veronica, too. Reggie's here. Hey, Jughead, where are you?
What would you call a game where you have to pull out a stick but not let any marbles fall? The more the claw, the more points against you. At first, it's easy not to kaplunk. Then it gets a little harder. And sometimes it's nearly impossible. What would you call it?
Well.
Did any of you recognize some of those things? We had the Archie Comics television show.
Oh.
First broadcast in 1968. The game Kerplunk. Did anyone play Kerplunk?
No.
Do you know what the game is?
No.
It's, yeah, you have this plastic tube and there's marbles on top and a whole bunch of sticks intertwined underneath it, and you're supposed to pull out sticks like Jenga before all the marbles fall.
Like it's a self-contained kind of Jenga because it's in a tube, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. David, did you ever play Kerplunk?
You never played it?
Yeah.
I just looking at the old commercials when I was internet searching, and I remember that it came back after a while. It was a trend, you know, from 68 when it was first released, but then it came back, and I think it outplayed itself, for lack of a better pun. But yeah. And then Hot Wheels.
That plays itself, sorry.
Hot Wheels, which I think are still around. I don't play with Matchbox type size cars. So
we had a lot of them as a kid.
Yeah.
Like, that was one of the cool cheap toys that could get underfoot and you know, cause real catastrophes in my household.
Yeah. Was it catastrophes like Legos, leaving Legos around?
We did that too. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I feel like doll parts taken apart and then put under people's feet when they're sleeping.
Okay. Yeah.
What were the cars that had that amazing burning metal smell all the time?
Ooh. Oh, shoot.
The ones on the slot cars. Remember those?
Yeah, totally. But
I don't know what
they smell like. Cordite when they were running around the track.
Yeah,
visceral. And
did you ever have them on like the ramps and seeing how fast you can?
Oh, no.
Shoot them down the ramps.
No. We couldn't afford ramps, but we could get
got the cars,
and then you know we lived on a second floor, so we had like this banister. And there was the trick of trying to get the car all the way down without it falling off the side. Yeah, which is, you know, it worked just as well. It was like I think maybe a bigger scale. But I wanted the doors to open on all of them and not all of them open.
Mm.
Physics experiments. It was also analog.
Right.
Back then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a, as I was searching around, there was an actual commercial now where a mom and a kid are driving in this like sports car, like an old school sports car, and their things are happening around them, and it's like, what can we do, mom? There's all these barrels in front of us. It's like, let's go around them. And she's like driving, like, you know, doing stunts and things, and it's actually supposed to be them playing together with these sports cars, and so they're jumping the little toy barrels, and
that's pretty cute.
Yeah, so it's like, we can do everything, you know, kind of thing. So
yes,
and finally that last piece you might have heard, you know, is from centuries ago, but it was actually during the trailer for the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Guess when it came out?
1968. Whoa.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. And so just a few of those things. And I thought it was kind of interesting that a lot of them dealt with the consumer nature of white folks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I found it really difficult to find things from 1968 that did not feature a white person.
Well, that's definitely the trend with that milieu in marketing, for sure. Like, mm-hmm. if we have an understanding of what the mainstream is now, it's dictated by the approach in 1968, for sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I want to point out one thing that it's not strictly that it came out in 1968, but it is my favorite TV show, The Prisoner, ended in 1968. I love it.
Yeah, explain to our listeners that might not know what that is.
Well, it is a British show with Patrick McGoohan, I think, or McGeenan.
McGoohan.
McGoohan. Thank you. And he is a spy that worked diligently for the British government and then is, you know, kidnapped and whisked away to this mysterious, like, isolated place where there's like a really specific authoritarian like regime, but also nobody has a name. Everybody is a number, and there are these like crazy weather balls that chase people around and like, you know, like mess up their days. And you know, Patrick McGoohan is like fixated on trying to figure out how to get out and who's in control, and the whole series, like, you know, focuses on that. And I love it because it's not simply that it's a you know, like a thriller mystery like kind of thing. It also has that like production value of the late 60s. And it is like, you know, I think not quite as cheesy as, you know, some things that you might see, but it is definitely like, you know, a product of its time in that way.
It was part of that surreal psychedelic series, mm-hmm. of thriller shows like The Avengers,
yes,
which kind of reached its height around 66 to 68 with Patrick McNee and Diana Rigg.
Mm-hmm.
And they would always just do sort of trippy things with the storyline. It wouldn't be a straightforward mystery at all.
Yeah, yeah. Like the number two, who was always torturing, you know, the star, number six, like always torturing
them. And the prisoner,
The prisoner just like continuously changed, though. Like they always died in like this really like spectacularly weird way, or like just got gotten rid of because they failed, presumably by number one, but you never know who number one is.
Hmm.
Who is number one? I am a man, not a number.
Keep going, Becky, keep going.
Sorry, I'm not a man, actually.
I know you were just quoting the show, so yeah. I wanted to encourage you. Keep quoting,
no!
Keep quoting.
Do you want to join in on this?
Actually grew up in England around that time.
Heckin'
That was kind of a golden age of TV for England back then. And you still see a lot of that being replayed over and over again. I mean, Doctor Who is a product of that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was a long-ranging series. It started in 1963 by, you know, I think one of the Doctors came out in 1968.
Let's see. Tom Baker was... No, he was in the 70s. Oh, 68 was John Pertwee, I think.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, cool.
So, and Doctor Who is still going on.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know what else is... it's not exactly the same. So Isaac Asimov released Asimov's Mysteries in 1968. But there's a long-running, monthly, I think, periodical of sci-fi works that is inspired by Asimov and is still being published because my mom gets them and loves them and devours them the moment they cross her threshold.
Wow. Science fiction.
Sci-fi.
Yeah. And not to give light to our local science fiction fantasy author, mm-hmm. Ursula K. Le Guin, some of her publications, including novella. It's a shortened story. So I think they might have called it a novelette, but it's titled Nine Lives. Was published in 1968 in Playboy magazine.
My
interesting how a creative writer like her would be published in Playboy back in the day.
That's common. I always think of like Vonnegut books, and it's like that 50s, 60s where, you know, they were filling up space in those magazines, and that's where a lot of sci-fi writers gravitated to. That's who would publish them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oddly enough, Hugh Hefner was a contributor to ERA and pro-ERA groups and a lot of other women's groups of the 1970s, so I'm not surprised.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, some of my other favorites came out that year, too. Not simply 2001 A Space Odyssey, but Rosemary's Baby.
Oh, no.
And The Night of the Living Dead. classic horror films.
All those horror films that... by today's standards, need to obviously be remade because some of them have been remade.
Has Rosemary's Baby been remade yet? Because
I think it has in some way.
Shape, or form. I don't know for sure, but
isn't there even like a Schwarzenegger movie like End of Days that was similar to? I don't know. Oh. They're always having, you know, the Spawn of Satan,
right?
Another trope.
Yeah, very much rehashed all the time. But mm-hmm. the fun of Rosemary's Baby was, I think, in the second watching for me, and then subsequent ones, because now you're kind of digging into like what is happening, like in the day-to-day, like, you know, retelling of things, like mm-hmm. looking at how people are interacting with the star, and then like, well, I mean, that's the cult. What's cultish about what they're doing right now?
Right.
So I love that part of it.
And also the first film of the Planet of the Apes was done in 1968. And I know that has been remade more than once.
And like Planet of the Apes and Space Odyssey kind of paved the way, because Planet of the Apes especially was such a blockbuster,
right?
Towards, you know, Star Wars. Mm-hmm. Fox took another chance. It was, you know, nearly 10 years later, but they're like, oh, all right, we'll let this guy do it.
We'll let this guy do it. That's,
you know,
fine.
No skin off our backs.
68. You know, my affinity towards the Beatles, of course, every year in this range of 10 years we're in is going to be like, oh, the Beatles released this because everything was great back in the, you know, 60s. So 68, they did the Beatles, the White Album. So that was it. And then Apple was formed in 68. Mm. The Good Apple by the Beatles. Apple Corps, that is.
Not the apple that is around.
Which is weird because they did have a lawsuit that was settled not too long ago because, you know, Beatles created Apple, and then Apple, who seems to think they created everything after someone else created it.
Oh, geez.
Sued the Beatles, and they settled it.
Right.
Now, did we mention Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood?
We did not.
Hey.
Because that, you know, people look at that as this wonderfully simplistic sort of thing from the, you know, past era. But in fact, it was an incredibly sophisticated idea that Fred Rogers, who had gone into television in its early days, local days in Pittsburgh, came up with to engage children who were stuck at home watching TV for most of the day, and to really sort of bring community values and outside learning. You know, he'd visit all these little places, and he ended up testifying in favor of public television and against cuts in front of Congress.
Inspiring, actually.
Yeah, he was the genuine article. I have friends who grew up in Pittsburgh who everybody has a story about meeting Mr. Rogers, and they're all like incredibly cool stories.
Yeah, I think Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood should be credited for, like, you know, kind of catalyzing the movement to create like the public media that we have today. And I think it's important to also note that, you know, educational programming prior to that was like a really sort of prosaic, boring thing. Like, it was like if you were in your high school geometry class and somebody took away all the visuals and all of the all of the being there and just broadcasted the teacher on the board. You know, like that wasn't
sort
quite
of like
compelling.
Whiteboard videos nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like whiteboard videos now. But you know, with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, now you have like the context of having somebody talking with you, not even really talking at you, because it always felt like his approach was like it was meant to build community, like you said, and so it engaged people on a different level and children on a different level that, you know, now we're seeing, like, you know, helps to, you know, build agency and like deeper learning and, you know, like teaching soft skills that aren't normally like passed along in a classroom setting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that sort of was a power, and that show is definitely revolutionary in a way that is understated and probably not as acknowledged.
And we've had a lot of auto-tuning people who get nerdy with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood now and do auto-tuned songs.
Mm-hmm. Those are pretty moving. The one I was listening to, I think it was, yeah, PBS had auto-tune a bunch of classic PBS stuff. And yeah, it's like, man, this is deep.
2018.
It's emotional. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had to look up. Sesame Street was 69. So next year we can talk about their 50.
Good.
There we go. Yeah, and I was also looking up for Reading Rainbow, but Reading Rainbow didn't come out till the 80s.
I thought I had read somewhere that the first video game was 1968. Turns out it was 1958. So it's 60 years old. Brookhaven National Laboratories had an early version of Pong called Tennis for Two.
Wow.
Up near Cornell.
Oh, my goodness.
And they had people, visitors were lining up to come in and play this thing on it. It just looked like sort of this waveform monitor.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Fascinating.
That's really cool. So many things have happened that are 50 years and counting. And so as we wind down, I just wanted to thank everyone for giving their input and celebrating the 50 years of KBOO, 50 years of geek stuff. And I'm sure we could probably have this be a running segment for future episodes, you know, an annual thing. What is 50 years this year?
Yeah.
And talk about more things, other things that are that have happened in 68 that I thought was pretty cool was the Jacques Cousteau undersea television special was first aired in 1968.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm all about the underwater adventures.
Oh.
And
Cousteau.
Yeah, right.
And
right.
It helped start the environmental movement to, you know, keep the waters clean.
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah. So, hence, somewhat educational as well, I would say, too. And then another thing is science-y, and if you want to get spacey on us, we can talk about the first pulsar was announced in 1968 by Jocelyn Bell Burnell and Anthony Hewish. And for those folks that don't know what exactly is a pulsar, the internet describes it as a celestial object thought to be rapidly rotating a rotating neutron star, emitting regular pulses of radio waves and other electromagnetic radiation at rates of up to 1,000 pulses per second. Yeah.
Discovered in 1968.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
I like how insignificant we are because of stuff like that. I just love it.
But it's still radio.
Yeah. I was going to say, maybe it was KBOO coming on the air that help to create the pulse. I'm just kidding. Like, we activated it with our radio wave.
Yay!
There's
a legal ID coming from way out in space.
There we go.
Beyond galaxies.
All right. And in the last couple of minutes, just wanted to give our listeners some things to look forward to, some events happening here in the Rose City. This weekend, February 1st through February 3rd, the Portland Winter Light Festival is happening on the waterfront outside of OMSI. Find out information about that at pdxwlf.com.
I think that there are a number of locations.
Oh, like perfect. Okay.
There's all the over Littman the city.
Gallery.
Okay. There's the Afro Gallery near KBOO.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of... Yeah, it all looks super, super
Open
cool.
Signal's doing something.
Nice.
To the yes.
Nice. Yes, so check that out this weekend. Lights are still happening in wintertime.
Bling, bling, bling.
The Worst Day of the Year run is happening February 3rd, starting at McMenamin's Edgefield. If you want to run, they call it the worst day of the year because it's apparently supposed to be raining and cold, but you
this
never
is
know
all
here.
Really confusing because there are two dates for worst day of the year events.
Wait, right. When's the worst day?
Right. So they have the worst day of the year run on February 3rd.
Tomorrow?
And then the worst day of the year bike ride on February 11th. So
maybe
I think that's up to judgment.
I think maybe it's the worst day of the year for a bike ride on the 11th, and then the 3rd is
we'll
the worst
see.
For
So if you're
running.
Interested in running, you can go to worstdayrun.com for info. And if you're interested in riding your bike with your family, you can check out worstdayride.com.
And report to us
which one was worst.
Yeah, because I went running this morning. I'm like, man, it is too nice. This is too nice to run right now.
It is way too nice. Dang it.
And so I guess we'll see if tomorrow's worse.
Yeah. And finally, if you're into some comedy shows from some local improv comic artists, the Comedy Sports Improv is hosting shows February 3rd through the 24th in Northwest Portland. Information can be found at portlandcomedy.com, and I believe they also have classes that you can take to learn improv as well. So yes, so check out some of those events in the Rose City. Tune in next month on Radio Geekly. I believe we might be talking about female identified geeks, because International Women's Day is happening in March, so that's going to be exciting.
Yes.
And so yeah, I just want to thank everyone in the studio, Conch, David, Becky. Thank you so much for joining in the conversation. Stay tuned at noon for Moving On, and thanks again for listening to your community radio station here, KBOO Portland. Take care.
Just have to play it to see what it is.
Do you ever imagine things?
Are they scary things?
Are they scary things?
Do you ever imagine things? Things you'd like to have. Did you ever see a cat's eyes in the dark and wonder what they were? Did you ever pretend about things like that? Did you ever